I'm Marty Moscawen. Welcome back to Radio Times. You know the proverb, old habits die hard, meaning it's difficult to change the behavior we're accustomed to doing that's become routine, even if it's a bad habit. How many New Year's resolutions to lose weight, get more exercise, cut back on spending fall apart, and we fall back on our slothful couch potato eating ways? Or think of those habits that can be a problem at work, things like being late or disorganized or argumentative. Taking all of this into account, what does it take to change old habits, shed bad ones, and get new ones, good ones? And we have three guests who have joined us, two of whom are with us here in our Philadelphia studio. Mitesh Patel is an assistant professor of medicine and healthcare management at the University of Pennsylvania, also a staff physician at the Philadelphia VA in Philadelphia, and has spent a lot of research looking at things like incentives. And Mitesh Patel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. Anna Papalia is with us as well. She's a career coach, founder of the career coaching and consulting firm called Shift. And Anna, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
And joining us by Skype is Amy Morin. She's a licensed clinical social worker, a psychotherapist, and author of 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. And Amy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with a definition. That's always a really boring way to start the show, but I want to make sure we're all on the same page here. And Anna, I'll start with you. So how should we think about what is a habit?
Well, it's a behavior that is something that is continual. We were just talking briefly about habits that are either bad or good. Obviously, good habits are things we don't really talk that much about. We don't think about them a lot. The bad habits get most of the attention. Bad habits are things like biting our nails, being chronically late, not responding to emails. These are habits that we try to fix because other people generally have a problem with them.
Right.
And often we do as well.
How would you define it?
So I tend to think of habits as either something you do routinely and you put a lot of thought into and it's planned and you do it consistently for a certain reason, or something that's done automatically. So there's some type of trigger or there's something that occurs and you're responding in the moment. And those are the habits, the way that you typically respond to those kind of stimulus.
Amy, how do you think of habits?
I think normally we think of behavioral habits like biting our nails, but I think it also incorporates thoughts that we have, whether we tend to think a certain way when something happens to us. But it can be emotional, too, whether we indulge in self-pity every time something bad happens, that our habits can encompass thoughts, feelings, and behaviors.
It's interesting, and we'll obviously be focusing a lot on bad habits, habits we want to get rid of. But you would think, you know, if something's a bad habit, you don't want to do it, then just don't do it. But it's obviously not that simple. What are some of the things people, Anna, should think about?
Sure. So if we think about habits as having a three-part system, there's a trigger, there's an action, and there's a benefit. So for example, if you're sitting at a stoplight and the light turns green, that's the trigger. And then the routine is you step on the gas. The benefit is you get closer to your destination. Now, if you think of a bad habit in the same context, it might help you figure out that trigger. And that's what you need to think about a little differently if you're going to change the behavior. So let's say your bad habit is biting your nails, for instance.
She looks at me. Go ahead, Anna.
You would want to think about what that trigger would be. Maybe someone told you a few minutes before that the test was going to be difficult. Maybe your trigger then is stress and anxiety. So instead of just thinking, okay, well, I'm not going to bite my nails the next time I'm stressed, instead replacing the habit, the bad habit, with a different one is a much more friendly approach, and we react better to it. Instead of telling our minds, we're just not going to do something, we're going to go cold turkey, instead thinking, well, the next time I want to bite my nails, I'm going to press this stress ball on my desk, or I'm going to walk around, stand up and get the stress out by walking around. If you replace the behavior, that will help tremendously.
But you're also saying have a plan, have a strategy. Don't just say, oh, I don't want to bite my nails anymore. Say, I'm going to do something else.
Plans are very important. Psychologists have found that if you write it down, you're three times more likely to be successful. And we call it if-then planning. Hmm. If I want to bite my nails, then I will squeeze the stress ball. If I feel as though I want to eat that cupcake, I will replace it with something else. Go for a walk, step away from the kitchen, give myself 20 minutes. and not do it.
Let me go back to you, Amy, and then I'll get back to you, Mitesh. Amy, and you referenced this earlier. I mean, there are all sorts of mental, I guess, triggers that can then activate these behaviors that perhaps we are not so proud of or we don't want to do. Help us, I guess, get us into the head of someone who's struggling with a bad habit.
Yeah, when our emotions play a big role into the behavior that we exhibit. So when you're calm and when you're having a good day, it's easy to say, I'm not going to do that anymore, whether it is I'm not going to eat junk food when I get home from work at the end of the day, or I'm not going to speed on my way home from work. But then when our emotions take over, it's really hard to not do those things. So whether you're exhausted or you're stressed out, then we tend to, it becomes much easier to indulge in those things we didn't want to do. So sometimes it's about making it more difficult to do those things. I've worked with people who are compulsive shoppers, where they just overspend whenever they're stressed out. And so I worked with one woman who came up with a plan to say, I'm going to freeze my credit card in a block of ice. That way, when I'm tempted to shop online, it's going to take me a while before I can melt down this block of ice and physically get to my credit card. And just having that opportunity to pause long enough to think about it really helped her to not be so impulsive and give in during those weak moments.
Was that her idea or yours to put her credit cards in a block of ice?
Well, we had talked about how do you come up with that to give yourself just that pause so that you don't give in a weak moment. And we had come up with a whole list of things. And ultimately, she said, that's the one I want to do because that will at least make me stop and think. And she got to the point at one time where she was trying to melt a block of ice under running water. And then she just stopped and laughed at herself and said, well, this is stupid. I don't need to buy anything that bad that I have to get to it right now.
And did that hold? Did that stick? I mean, once she could put the credit card back in her wallet, was she able to stay away from excessive or obsessive shopping?
Yeah, it really served as a good reminder to her that, you know, exactly how ridiculous some of her behavior had become when she was feeling overly emotional, that she tended to be impulsive. And so when she was able to really take a step back and figure out, how do I retrain my brain to think about these things differently? And how do I start to recognize those emotions that trigger my behavior? Really helped her just build her awareness of it so that she could take a moment to pause even when her credit card wasn't in a block of ice.
Mitesh, let me turn to you. You've done some really interesting research about the use of incentives. Walk us through the outlines of this research. What were you looking to understand and how did you conduct it?
Sure. So I think one of the most important things to think about with habits or bad behaviors is that most people are aware of them. So they know what they're doing, yet they're still unable to change. Because the conventional wisdom is that if we can just educate people on how to change their behaviors or why it's good to change their behaviors, they'll do so. But we know that half of adults in the United States don't get enough exercise, even though they know
that
it's
good for
them.
And they know it, right?
And they know it. And people who smoke know that it causes cancer, yet they have a hard time quitting. And so there's been a lot of interest in ways that we can motivate people to change their behaviors. And so incentives have become very popular. About 85% of large employers in the United States use some form of financial incentives for health promotion. And the Affordable Care Act has provided a huge stimulus to this by increasing the proportion of our health insurance premiums that we can use as incentives from 20% to 30%. And if you include tobacco, you can actually use half of your health insurance premiums to do this. But it turns out the important thing is how the incentive is designed. Most incentives are designed assuming people are perfectly rational, that they're going to maximize their value.
And you're here to tell us that we're not rational
exactly.
beings.
That's not how our brains are wired. So we tend to prefer immediate gratification. We want to avoid losing things more than we want the benefit that we gain from getting them. We're more engaged by variable rewards than constant rewards. That's why so many people are so engaged in lotteries and things of that nature. So we conducted a randomized controlled trial. We enrolled 281 people who were overweight or obese. They ended up having a mean body mass of about 33. And they were in a workplace, and we asked them to track their step counts using their smartphone. And we chose smartphones because 70% of people have them across the country. They carry them wherever they go, and it can be done very passively. And we randomized them to a control arm where they just got feedback on whether or not they had achieved their 7,000 step goal, or one of three incentive arms. Now, the standard approach is to say, if you achieve your step goal, we're going to pay you a certain amount. In this study, we chose a value of $1.40 per day.
And it was 7,000 steps. That was the goal.
That was the goal. And that's kind of the minimum amount that evidence has shown that you need to start gaining health benefits from physical activity. In the standard arm, we paid people $1.40 each day. In a lottery arm, we put them in a lottery every day during the month, which equated to about $1.40 per day. And in the loss framing arm, we told people that $42 is put in a virtual account with your name on it, and each day you don't meet the goal, we'll take $1.40 away. And what's interesting is all three of these arms, we told people that you're going to receive a check at the end of the month with your total accumulated winnings. And across the arms, the value is equal. So you would expect, you know, theoretically, that people should behave the same. But that's not what we found.
Not at all. What did you find?
So we found that in the gain arm, where you paid people, very transactional in nature, kind of takes the standard economics approach, people achieved the goal about 35% of the time, compared to a control group, which didn't get any money, achieved the goal 30% of the time.
So not much difference.
Small increase, but statistically no difference over a three-month period. But the loss framing arm, where we told people the money was put in an account and taken away, was significantly more improvement. They achieved the goal 45% of the time, or a relative increase of about 50%.
Almost half the time. So what does that tell us then in terms of incentives? That somehow is that reward and punishment? I mean, are they being punished for not hitting that 7,000 step a day marker?
So I think it tells us a couple of things. The first thing is that the design of the incentive is critical to its success. So you can't just assume that if you're going to spend X amount of money, that you can offer it in a certain method and it's going to work. The same value of money offered differently created dramatically different outcomes. People often wonder, how should we balance carrots versus sticks, carrots being rewards and sticks being punishment. I think it's important to note in this study that we weren't actually taking money away from people. People tend to be very loss averse, which we know is a behavioral economic principle, but nobody actually was worse off at the end of the day. Actually, if you achieved the goal 10 days out of the month in any of the arms, you'd get paid the exact same. We tend to think of this as more of like a frozen carrot, where we kind of akin to the frozen carrot. So
right.
Where we give you a reward and it's slowly thawing over time, and at the end of the month, you'll get it. So this was just a different way to frame that reward.
And we're almost having a break here, but transferring that from money to biting nails, which seems to be a theme of the show so far. I mean, is there a way to think of using that to get rid of a behavior that has nothing to do with money per se?
Yeah, I think the way to take this and translate into other contexts is to think about ways that you can put some skin in the game. And this skin in the game can be financial. There are certain websites and apps that you can put money down, or you can tell your friend you're going to put so much money down. But it can also be a social incentive. So holding yourself accountable to a family member or friend can be a very strong motivator. And it's essentially your kind of reputation on the line here. And by just taking something that you do privately, like taking your medicine in the privacy of your own bathroom, and making it more public and letting somebody know when you did or did not take your medicine, can help you improve how often you actually remember to take it.
Well, I'm going to pick up on all of that. We are talking about breaking old habits and making new ones with Mitesh Patel, Anna Papalia, and Amy Morin. You can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us much more after this short break. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, and again, we're talking about breaking old habits, making new ones. And we just heard Mitesh Patel talk about some of the research that he has been doing about using incentives. And again, he's an assistant professor of medicine and healthcare management at the University of Pennsylvania, also a staff physician at the Philadelphia VA. Anna Papalia is with us as well, career coach, founder of the career coaching and consulting firm called Shift. And joining us by Skype, Amy Morin. She's a licensed clinical social worker, a psychotherapist, author of a book called 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. I'm curious, Anna, as you were listening to Mitesh talk about the kind of incentive research that he's been doing and some of the conclusions, what's your takeaway?
My takeaway is that willpower is a limited resource. We can't, and I think this is why we know that New Year's resolutions fail, because we go in thinking, I'm just not going to do something. I'm going to force myself to go to the gym, or I'm going to force myself to not bite my nails. But the research shows that willpower is a limited resource. It's not something that we can force ourselves to do. We have to have an alternate plan. We have to have replacement habits. And we need to reframe our thinking around the triggers that cause us to do these behaviors. If your only plan is to not do something, it will most surely fail.
Because you feel, because not doing something feels a little bit like deprivation, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Like, I can't do this.
Mm-hmm. Talk about reward and punishment.
Exactly.
And that might feel pretty good for the first month when you're sort of punishing yourself for being bad for eating the whole month of December. And in January, you have to go to the gym. But it's not a long-term strategy. And it's not something that will create a habit. And the other research on habits is that I know that this is a myth out there that it takes 21 days to create a habit. In fact, it takes much longer than that, unfortunately.
Really?
It takes almost 5 months. And so if you fall into this habit, well, I can just force myself to do something for 21 days, that sounds totally reasonable. Unfortunately, you can. And then you start to feel bad about yourself. And then you really will fall back on old patterns like eating or biting your nails or whatever it might be that makes you feel better. So instead, it is consistency and dedication that creates a habit, mm-hmm. and knowing that it's going to take time and having a plan where you can expect challenges and failures as well.
Amy, let me get you back in on the conversation. And oftentimes, I think when people are trying to give up a bad habit, they are a bit at war with themselves. I mean, they're having an argument with themselves, perhaps saying on a day when you want to have that second cupcake, oh, I'm having a bad day, maybe just this one time, it's too hard, I'm going to give up on this. To help us understand, I guess, the mental gymnastics we sometimes put ourselves through when we're trying to get rid of a bad old habit and acquire a better new one.
When we are struggling with that, we're sort of wrestling with ourselves, it's easy to find 101 ways to sort of justify your decision of why you should eat dessert, or you should be able to have that, you know, second bowl of ice cream or whatever it is. And one of the secrets that can help with that is to write a letter to yourself that says, here's all the reasons why I want to stick to my diet, or and then leave it in a place that's accessible to you. So whether you have to, you hang that on the refrigerator so that you have to see that list before you go, or I've worked with people who will say, you know, I keep talking to this ex that I shouldn't, but when he calls, I can't help but answer the phone. And so I've had them leave a letter to themselves or a list of 10 reasons why I shouldn't pick up the phone right on their phone. And then they were confronted with it. Or for somebody who says, I really want to go work out at the gym when I get out of work, but at the end of the day, I'm tired and I just want to drive home. They leave a list on their steering wheel of the top reasons why they should go work out. And when you're then confronted with sort of the other side of that argument, even when you don't want to think about it, it can help you say, okay, well, you're right, and I should go do this, and really raise your logic when you're feeling emotional and motivate you to do those things and to figure out, how do I hold myself accountable? And sometimes that involves using somebody else, an accountability partner, but knowing this is how I'm going to do it. And I've had people who will say, you know, I wake up in the morning and I don't feel like going to work, so then I call in sick, but then I get in trouble because I keep using too much sick leave. So we set up a plan where they have to call somebody, whether it be their best friend or their mother, or I even had one person that called me, and he'd leave a message that would say, okay, I know I should go to work today, and here's all the reasons why I should do it, but I don't want to. Well, he'd get halfway through that message and say, well, this is stupid. I should really go to work. And he'd motivate himself to go into the office even when he didn't feel like it.
And Mitesh, what I hear all three of you saying is that you need to have a buddy or someone or a scold or a nag or someone to kind of keep you on track when you feel like, I'm going to break this rule that I just set for myself.
Yeah, we know social incentives can be very powerful. People who have a buddy to go to the gym with, tend to go to the gym more often than they do alone. There's some evidence to suggest that if people want to quit smoking or lose weight or be more physically active, they are more likely to do that if their spouse or partner does that. And you think about a lot of the programs we try to do to help people quit smoking. If their partner is smoking and they're not in a program to quit smoking or aren't interested, it makes it really hard for that person to do. Or if their partner is the one who's preparing the meals and they're trying to lose weight, it makes it really challenging. Yeah. So we really need to think about, what's the support structure in our lives that help us do the things we do, and how can we leverage that to improve our health?
Well, and also Amy was talking about, you know, leaving notes to yourself, which is a very rational thing to do. I'm looking at you because you talk about how we do have our irrational sides that can talk us in and out of things all the time.
Yeah, I mean, one of the principles that we often think about is commitment devices. And I think about the notes being one level of those. So in some of our studies, we have participants sign pre-commitment contracts that they'll strive to achieve their physical activity or weight loss goal. And anytime they sign in to the technology platform to see how they're doing, that contract is sitting there in front of them with their signature. And it's kind of a reminder. Putting money down, your own money, as opposed to the way we did it here where we gave people money, is just a stronger form of a commitment contract. And it's putting more skin in the game and helping you to remind you that you've committed to a goal and it's something that you want to achieve.
And what do you do when you fail, Amy? Excuse me, Anna.
Well, I just wanted to go back to that.
Please,
real quickly.
No, go ahead.
I also think a bad habit in work that I work with my clients on trying to amend is email bad habits. And one of the things that one of the steps you need to take at the beginning of figuring out how to fix a bad habit is sort of taking stock. First, understanding what you do. So there are some great apps like Toggle, which is a time tracking device, which helps you understand where are you spending most of your time? Why aren't you going to your inbox and answering these emails? What happens when an email comes in and you decide to ignore it? So first, it's figuring that out. And the second step would be creating a friendly atmosphere. So if you want to lose weight, for example, don't buy the ice cream. You don't get extra credit for having ice cream in your house and not eating it. You don't get extra credit for trying to manage an inbox that's a mess. So that would be the second step, would be to organize it, create files, and then have a strategy and a plan. Mm-hmm. When this email comes in from my boss, that has to be responded to immediately. When this happens, I can just simply delete those, or I'm going to go through and unsubscribe from all things that don't need my immediate attention. That way, you're starting out almost with a clean slate and a strategy to make things much easier for you to go forward and be successful.
And when you talk about email bad habits, it's not answering emails in a timely manner? Is that the sort of main complaint people have about other people?
That, and also I think from a personal standpoint, people feeling overburdened by having 12,000 emails in their inbox. Even though they answered the most pressing ones and they got to the people that they needed to, they don't file away the old ones and they still have this looming number sitting in their inbox. And it's a psychological weight on you. And that's a bad habit that people want to break.
It leads to avoidance, I guess. What you just don't want to even go there.
Exactly. And that part of that strategy of organizing it is to have a plan. If this email comes in, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to trash that one. I'm going to file this one. And I have to reply to those.
We have an email from Yossi. He says, my company gives incentives through gift cards and Fitbit-type trackers to stay active. Of course, they have a financial incentive to keep employees healthy as well. Does that seem like a good work incentive?
Definitely. I think there's a lot of workplaces that are interested in this. There's been a huge rise in the popularity of workplace wellness programs. The person is right in that, the employer would like to help their employees get more healthy. That helps them reduce their costs, improve employee productivity. But it also creates a good culture. You want your employees to be healthy and to be able to engage, creates kind of a culture of health within the workplace. Now, it turns out that how these incentives design are often not in the best way, and we're hoping that some of the evidence can help move that field forward. And they're often kind of a one-size-fits-all, where we're going to offer a program to all of our thousands of employees, and it turns out that people respond differently to different types of incentives. Some might respond better to financial incentives of some sort, others to social incentives.
What about trackers? I mean, this was part of some of the research you did, which is just giving people feedback, saying you walked 7,262 steps today. Is that rewarding? Does that help to create good habits, or is it more that they're kind of people that will respond to those kinds of feedbacks?
Yeah, many people are interested in the kind of promise of wearable devices and being able to quantify itself, being able to track yourself and figure out how well you're doing and how you can change. And it turns out that the only people that use that data well are the ones that are already very motivated or already kind of on top of their health, the people who go run 5 miles a day, go out and buy a wearable device. The people who are, have chronic conditions like diabetes or heart failure or overweight or obese, even with the information alone, it's often challenging. So we often recommend that these these technologies are necessary, but they're not alone sufficient. They need to be combined with an appropriate behavior change strategy to be able to work for sustained behavior change.
And that's Mitesh Patel, along with Anna Papalia and Amy Morin. And we are talking about breaking old habits, making new, better habits. And again, you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Amy, so what are some of the 13 things mentally strong people don't do?
Well, the first one on the list is that they don't feel sorry for themselves. We know that when you're trying to change something in your life, hosting a pity party just slows you down and keeps you from moving forward. And another one is that they don't make the same mistakes over and over again. The way that we respond to a mistake when it happens, it really makes a big difference in whether we reach our overall goal. And viewing something as a marathon rather than a sprint is really the key to overcoming your mistakes.
Anything else?
Sure, that they don't give up after their first failure. If you decide you're going to go on a diet and you eat a cupcake, it doesn't mean that you're a complete failure. It just means you made a mistake. And then how do you move forward when you do fail? And we know that when we look at success stories, they often start out with a whole long history of failures. And it's the people that learn from their failure that really go on to make the biggest successes out of those failures.
I heard, Mitesh, you were talking about smoking. I mean, as an ex-smoker, I think that is one. I mean, there's the addiction problem, but then there are all the habits and sensations that are associated with smoking. Is that one of the hardest habits to try to break?
Smoking is certainly one of the hardest habits because of what you note, the addiction. There's a chemical process that's wired with your brain that does that. There are a lot of different methods to try to help people quit smoking. We find that about 5% of people who try end up quitting smoking, even among the most that are motivated. Mm-hmm. There are medications, there are support groups, and so on. Some of my colleagues have done some large randomized trials looking at ways to use financial incentives. There was a study published a few months ago in the New England Journal of Medicine led by Scott Halpern and other colleagues at Penn, where they looked at offering incentives over a 12-month period and found that you could actually triple smoking cessation rates over a year long, so it's from 5% to 15%, by offering financial rewards for people to help quit. And CVS was so impressed by the results of the study that they took the findings and implemented a nationwide financial incentive program to help their employees quit smoking.
But talking about the research that you did, which, let's take a smoker, you give them $40 at the end of the month. Every time they have a cigarette, you reduce, what, 10 cents or something like that? Would that be an effective way to try to stop smoking?
Well, you know, it's challenging in terms of, a lot of these activities with wearable devices, you can monitor that in real time. With cigarettes, you know, we can't do that yet. Yeah. Once you want to avoid something that's called the peanuts effect, where you're giving somebody an incentive that's too small to really matter, like 10 cents. So it needs to be put up there. So ways that you can frame that are putting a larger dollar amount. So the study that our colleagues did was around $750 to $800 for the year. So it's a large amount of money. Now, employers are interested in doing this because they can potentially save thousands of dollars in costs. And so those kind of larger incentives can be very powerful and can be used in the real world.
And I have a question for you from Patricia. She says, any advice for conquering what I call unconscious habits? I'm talking about, in my case, constantly saying, you know, when I talk. I find it hard to imagine the planning steps you're talking about for other habits because I'm not even aware of a bad habit. And I think there are probably other people that, like Patricia, would like to take care of some of these verbal tics or habits.
Absolutely. As a career coach, I have a great opportunity in that I mock interview some of my clients and students, and I am able to videotape them and play it back for them. I don't even really have to be in the room oftentimes. I hit play and I always say, so what do you think? And they know right away.
They hear it, right?
Mm-hmm. So as we just said at the top of the hour, people understand what their bad habits are. Then it's about becoming really conscious of them. And I always coach my clients to start paying attention to it. First, for a couple of weeks, just become aware of the behavior. If you're saying, you know, count how many times you're doing it, try to challenge yourself, and you still need a strategy or a plan. What do I say instead? And also hold yourself accountable by asking your supervisor or peers at work, what's my presentation? How am I coming across? If someone says, you don't look very professional when you say that, that's going to stick with you, and you're going to be more motivated to change that behavior.
Amy, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, as odd as it sounds, sometimes what can help is to actually stand in front of a mirror and keep doing whatever your bad habit is. So if you keep saying, you know, keep doing it in front of a mirror, or if you, I work with people that pick their skin or pull out their hair. They're not even aware that they're doing it because it's such a habit. But when you start doing it and forcing yourself to do it, it actually raises your consciousness when you say, oh, this is, these are the steps that go into my bad habit. And then you become more aware when you're doing it out in public or when you're doing it when you don't necessarily want to. So sometimes I tell people to set aside 15 minutes a day to stand in front of a mirror and just do whatever it is that you want to get rid of, and just to raise your awareness of it so that when you go out there and do it, you're much more aware and conscious of, oh, here we go again. And then you can help make it stop after you've raised your level of awareness.
You're nodding your head, Anna. Go ahead.
It's very difficult to do the thing that you don't want to do when you're staring at yourself. And department stores have found this. There's a reason why there are mirrors all over department stores, especially at entrance and exits, is because it's to deter shoplifters. You are much less likely to do something bad if you can see yourself in the mirror doing it. So back to her earlier point, if you write a letter to yourself, that's great. Stick it on a mirror and read it to yourself while you're looking in the mirror. It's very difficult to not go to the gym or to say, you know, when you're staring at yourself in the mirror.
Makes sense to you?
Yeah, totally agree. Kind of harnessing that intrinsic motivation by making yourself more aware.
Because, I mean, a lot of habits, especially things you do over time, you're not aware of them. I mean, you're aware, but you're sort of not aware at that moment. So sort of seeing yourself, it seems, I'm looking at you, Mitesh.
Yeah, they tend to become automatic, just responses to things that you're just used to doing, the norm. And a good way to change that is just to make yourself aware and figure out how you can move forward.
I think we are aware, but we like to think that we don't do them as much.
Gotcha.
Or no one else notices them. No one heard me say, you know, for the 17th time. No one notices that I don't respond to emails on time or that I'm never on time to meetings. Everyone notices. I think this is also a fundamental sort of denial strategy that we use.
Go ahead. She heard the music. No, go ahead. Just
I was
very
gonna
quickly.
Say, we tend to think that no one else notices these things, but everyone does. So we have to start getting aware.
We are talking about changing old habits or bad habits, acquiring new habits. I do want to talk a bit more about that after this very short break. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with our guests about what to do about some of these habits we're not so proud of or we would like to change. Also, how to acquire new ones. And let me quickly reintroduce our guest to you. Amy Morin is a licensed clinical social worker. She's a psychotherapist, author of a book called 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do, and she is joining us by Skype. Anna Papalia, a career coach, founder of the career coaching and consulting firm called Shift. And Mitesh Patel is an assistant professor of medicine and healthcare management at the University of Pennsylvania, staff physician at the Philadelphia VA. And all of them sharing ideas about what to do about habits. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Amy, we haven't really talked about, acquiring new good habits. We've been talking about how to shed some of these old habits. What should people think about?
Well, one thing is to set yourself up for success. If you say, okay, my new habit is I'm going to go running every morning before I go to work. Well, put your sneakers next to the bed so that when your alarm goes off, you then are faced with, oh yeah, that's what I'm supposed to do today. And sometimes just taking as many steps as you can to make it easy for yourself by planning ahead and then saying, well, what am I going to do when times get tough, to know that there will be days where it's much more difficult, whether it be there's a party at work or something where you're going to be tempted to then know, okay, well, then how do I keep up with my good habits even on those days, or days where you work later, or days where it's going to be much more difficult. But when you plan ahead, then you greatly increase the chances that you'll stick to your new habits.
You agree with that, Anna?
Absolutely. I would also say try to pick the right habit to start with. Don't try to quit smoking and diet and go to the gym every day and eat well. That you are going to fail. You can really only focus on two things at once and know that. And also know that there will be days that you do fail, and that's okay. Don't let perfect be the enemy of good, as they say. Just doing something towards your goals or your habits once a day will be the motivator in itself, and that will help you continue on because, like I said earlier, it does take quite a while to develop these habits. So pick one that's just right. Pick maybe your email habits or getting places on time. That's sort of a medium-sized habit to tackle before you try to work on stopping smoking, quitting smoking.
And have, what, a short-term goal? I mean, something that's not on the horizon but more achievable than that?
I would say, because I think our success is the biggest motivator. If you feel as though you're successful, whether it be a monetary success or external success, whatever it will be, that will motivate you further.
What do you think, Mitesh?
Yeah, I definitely agree. You need to try to pick one goal that you want to focus on. It's hard to do a lot of things at once. I think one of the most important things is recognizing what you can do to help better engage you in that goal, whether it's a workplace wellness program, whether it's finding somebody else, a friend or family member or coworker that has the same goal as you. Those type of behavior change strategies are really important when we look at people that were successful versus those that were not. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes people will try to lose weight or try to quit smoking over and over and over, and they're doing the same thing. And they need to look for new, more creative ways to engage in that behavior change.
Amy, we've been talking a lot about people doing this, initiating all this themselves. But what about when someone says to you, you know, you have a really annoying habit of, you know, smacking your teeth when you eat or something like that, or smacking your lips when you eat. When someone is in a sense criticizing someone for their bad habits, what's going on there, and how do you suggest people respond?
Well, you know, change doesn't happen overnight anyway. There's a process that goes on behind the scenes where the stages of change. So we start out and we don't want to change, or we don't recognize a habit. When somebody raises our awareness of it, then we're in the second step, which is contemplation. So then you either think, well, maybe that is a problem, but maybe you deny it too. And you think, no, I don't do that. So it all depends on where you are. But sometimes having that feedback from people can be just what we need to sort of move us to that next step. And once we start thinking about the pros and cons, or is this something I want to change, then the next step is that you'd plan ahead to say, okay, well, then if I do want to change this, how would I go about that? And then you move on to action. But you really have to figure out first, is it a problem? And so sometimes we don't recognize our problems. And getting feedback from other people, just, I think, to be able to view that with an open mind and to say, well, is this a problem? And even if it's not a problem for me, might it be a problem for other people? And how do I affect other people with my behavior? Once you can really think about that with an open mind, then you can make a decision. We know that if you try to change something just because somebody else tells you to, you're not likely to stick with it. You have to be motivated. But if you can use that to help you figure out if that's really something you need to change in your life and that you are motivated to do, then it can help you move forward and become much more successful.
You want to add to that, Anna?
Sure. I think it's also really important to know about habit creation that if you are starting a new job, let's say, or maybe even in a new relationship, you're starting with a clean slate, and you can seek out advice, and especially in a work environment. I consult with corporations where I'm fortunate to go in and meet with all of their employees on the first day and teach them the rights and wrongs, corporate expectations. I give them a to-do list and a to-don't list. It's one of the best ways to create great habits before the bad ones even get started. So let's nip all these problems in the bud and give you these corporate expectations from day one.
Clean slates work. I mean, sort of saying, okay, you know, now I'm going to actually incorporate some of this stuff. Is that helpful, Mitesh?
Yeah, I think making the good habit the default behavior, the standard, the norm is a great way to be able to get people off on the right foot.
Let me get Gary from, looks like, Wilmington, Delaware. Hi, Gary. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi. I hope you can hear me okay.
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Fascinating discussion. I'm actually a chronic pain pharmacist, and I have a PhD in neuropharmacology, all based on the neuroplastic changes that happen in chronic pain states. So literally, we rewire our nervous system in a chronic pain state. The comment just earlier about nipping things in the bud is so important, because once we lay down neuronal pathways, we literally have to tear down those same pathways while we form other pathways to develop the new habits. And so it's no wonder it doesn't take 21 days. It takes months, if not years, to rewire this entire system. I just wanted to hear some comments from the speakers about that. Thank you.
You're welcome, Gary. Thanks for the call. Mitesh, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, many of the behaviors that we do are based on how our brains are wired to respond to the environment. You know, there are things you can change in the environment. You can change the way you react to some of these things. But really setting the stage for that and changing that is hard, and it will take a long time.
Yeah. Let me get Barbara from Cheltenham to join our conversation. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
I am a hair puller. It's a cool word to say, trichotillomania, but it's not a cool kind of an obsession to have. I have done this ever since I was a small child. I have tried everything from adverse conditioning, being told to pinch myself whenever I feel the urge to pull hair, make a chart, document how many times you go to do this, how many times you actually do this. It has plagued me my entire life. I'm very aware that I have the terrible habit,
right,
but often I'm not aware that I'm doing it
until after
I've already completed the action.
Well, Barbara, let me see if we can get some help for you. And I'm going to start with you, Anne, and then Amy and perhaps Mitesh as well.
Barbara, in all of that work, have you thought about what the trigger is beforehand?
No, because it doesn't necessarily have one. It sometimes has to do with the fact if I'm using my hands, of course I'm not going to touch my hair. If one hand is free, if I'm only using the other hand, maybe that hand will pull. It doesn't necessarily have to do with stress. I've really tried to analyze it because I've been hoping to try to put it down to a low roar.
I think that's the best.
Are you
place
pulling
to
your
be.
Hair out or you're twiddling?
Yes, I pull it out.
Oh, you're pulling it out. Gotcha.
Yes. There have been times when I've even made little bald spots.
Wow.
And I know it, and I know that that can happen, and I look in the mirror and I go, this is awful, but still. And I can go for a period of time and not do it. And I don't know how that kind of resolution time comes about or what causes it to start up again. But I can remember doing this when I was a small child in my parents' home.
It's interesting. And Barbara, you should know that our guests don't know you and all of that, so whatever they tell you is limited. But I'm back to you, Anna.
What we know about habit formation is that everything has a trigger. Sometimes they're very deep, but it's there. So doing the work around figuring out what happens before you go to pull your hair, bite your nails, whatever that is, this might take some deep work. Like the previous caller says, this is a very ingrained habit. Mm-hmm. And I think that would be the first step, figuring out where it comes from, what that unconscious trigger is, so you can start reframing whatever that trigger is.
What do you think, Amy?
Trichotillomania is a really hard thing to treat, and unfortunately, it's an interesting phenomenon that to the rest of us, we say, well, don't pull out your hair, and it seems like it would be really simple, but people that struggle with that, and as well as compulsive skin pickers, it's not that easy, and so sometimes people have worked with a psychiatrist to get on medication that can help them reduce the impulses, and it can help with some of that rewiring so that they don't do it anymore. And other people have had success with things like habit reversal, where you just raise your awareness of it, because sometimes people will say, well, I'm just watching TV and the next thing I know, I've got this clump of hair in my hand and I wasn't even aware that I was doing it. So that works for some people. But if it doesn't, I would definitely suggest speaking to a doctor about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mitesh, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would echo that. You know, you start off by the caller, start off by mentioning the medical term for this. So it's important to know that you're not alone in this. This is something that's seen commonly and there's a diagnosis for. Certainly some people are able to do this on their own, but it's very challenging. And there are things like cognitive behavioral therapy and medications and things that work for some people and don't work for others. It just, but I would recommend, you know, talking to your doctor and figuring out the best plan.
Yeah. And I appreciate the call to Radio Times, Barbara. Let me get Jackie from Marion to join us. Hi, Jackie. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
So my question is, if you have any advice for chronically late people or advice on how to be on time.
Are we talking about ourselves, Jackie?
Yes. And also a lot of people that I know, but mostly me.
But mostly you. And are you, I mean, people say, Jackie, my chronically late friend, are you known for your chronic lateness?
Yes.
Yes.
I am.
And are we talking an hour, 20 minutes?
usually about 20 minutes, but it depends on the distance that I have to go to get wherever I'm going.
All right. Well, let me go ahead.
Stretches. Sorry, it depends. It stretches depending on the distance.
Well, let me start with Amy. What do you think, Jackie? Well, what advice do you have for Jackie?
Well, one thing is to figure out sort of why you're late. Sometimes people will say, well, I don't want to leave early because I don't want to waste any time. And other people will say, well, I planned to leave at 12:15, but then before I knew it, you know, it was 12:10 and I hadn't even made an attempt to put my shoes on or find my jacket or get ready. And so then they just end up accidentally being late. And so if that's the case, you can just plan ahead by saying, okay, what time, work backwards. What time do I need to leave the house? What time should I get ready? What time, and to have a schedule for yourself. If I'm ready by noon, then I can leave the house at 12:30 or something like that, just so you can say, okay, I'm going to plan ahead so I can be in those places. And then to make sure that other people haven't made it too easy for you. Sometimes when we're known for being chronically late, our friends say, yeah, we'll meet you at 12, but they know you're not going to show up until 12:30. So they start being late too. And then it just becomes more and more of a habit. So to figure out, well, okay, if we say noon, how do we hold ourselves accountable so that we actually show up at noon and respect everybody's time? And that can really help you to say, okay, how do we all be more accountable to make sure that we're all going to be on time?
And your friend's lying to you about when you're supposed to be there, knowing that you're going to be late. And so they take it from there. Do you want to add anything to that, Mitesh?
Yeah. You know, you want to think about what might be the right incentive to help motivate you to be on time. And there's this story about a daycare center where parents were, you know, continually coming late to pick up their children. And the daycare wanted to do something to change that. And so what they did is they implemented a charge. If you're late by 15 minutes, for every 15 minutes you're late, you have to pay an extra $5. And what happened was that more people started being late because they started saying, well, I'm going to be half an hour late. I'll just pay $10 for it. So you really want to think about the incentives there. You know, if you're continuing to be late and, you know, obviously it's not affecting your job because you're still working there. You're not being fired because of it. What is it about the situation that could really motivate you? And in some cases, that could be a financial incentive. But with the example I gave, that didn't work out so much. So you might think about social incentives as well. And then you really just have to try the different approaches and see what's best for you.
Yeah. You want to add anything to that, Anna?
Sure. Well, when it comes to work, this can really affect your ability to get a promotion, to be taken seriously. And that might be a big motivator for someone. If you can't get to the meeting on time, no one in the room is going to think that you have anything valuable to add. They're going to think that you're unprofessional. So thinking of it in those terms, that your inability to get somewhere on time will affect your career and the way people look at you. We call it a personal brand. Do you want someone to think that about you? The first thing they think, oh, the girl who's always late? That's not really the way I would want someone to see me.
We're almost out of time here, but what about thinking about the effect on others? I mean, you're going to meet someone for lunch and they're sitting there for half an hour waiting for you. Yeah. Is that for some people that might change their behavior?
Exactly. Like I was saying earlier, some of the research also shows that we tend to believe that other people give us the benefit of the doubt. Well, I'm wearing a wrinkled shirt, they'll understand. Or I'm late to the meeting because my toddler was up all night long. In fact, what we found is, no, that's not the case at all. People don't give other people the benefit of the doubt. They just look at you and think, you're a slob. You're in a wrinkled shirt. Unfortunately, we just look at other people and think they're rude, impatient, and lazy instead of thinking, oh, well, you know,
having a bad morning.
Yeah, we don't think that of others. So we can all work on that and give people the benefit of the doubt, but I don't want anyone thinking that someone's going to think that about me.
Well, we're going to end on that note because we are out of time. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Amy Morin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And she's a clinical social worker, psychotherapist, wrote a book called 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. Anna Papalia, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you so much.
And she has a career coaching and consulting firm called Shift. And Mitesh Patel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. An assistant professor of medicine and healthcare management at the University of Pennsylvania, a staff physician at the Philadelphia VA. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and much, much more. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. Susan Greenbaum helping us out this week. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.